You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
I talk about in the book is nostalgia is the worst. The good old days were not good. The good old days sucked. It's one of my big themes because I think it's a thief of joy, this idea that we should be all in the past and everything was great. And it's dangerous, too. It's dangerous because when you glorify the past, you don't realize how much progress we've made. And then you become a nihilist and like, everything sucks. Let's just throw it all away and elect someone who has never been in office because he can't do worse. Well, in my opinion, he's done a lot worse.
But do you think... gratitude kind of helps against these thieves of joy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I quote in the book this this Benedictine monk who says, happiness does not lead to gratitude. Gratitude leads to happiness. And there's a lot of studies to back this up.
I've written a lot about gratitude in articles. And there's a lot of science that stress is inflammatory in the system and inflammation in the body is harmful in a number of ways, from cancer to diabetes to Alzheimer's. And gratitude directly fights that. Like, if you're feeling stressed about the airport, that's gonna be slightly inflammatory, even microscopically inflammatory somewhere in your body. But if you replace it with gratitude, it's just, I don't need the science to know that that's gonna be a naturally healthy thing.
And yeah, there's a huge amount of evidence that it's good for you. You know, I never believe just one study, but there are so many studies that...
Like, what else does it help you with?
I read one study that it makes you a better athlete. I don't believe that, but because I spent a year thanking people, and, you know, I cannot run a 30-second 100-yard dash.
AJ Jacobs, thank you for being on the podcast.
And thank you. Are you kidding?
And we're celebrating the release of your book yesterday, Thanks 1000, A Gratitude Journey. And I just want to describe this book for a second. We talked about it a little on the last podcast, but not really in depth. But what you basically did here was a lot of people are grateful for like, I'm grateful for this cup of coffee. I'm grateful my kids are alive. I'm grateful I woke up today. I'm grateful the sun is shining. And the gratitude, I've read... Since reading your book, I've done some research on the science of it too. When you're just grateful like that, the intensity of each moment of gratitude is not very big. So, and there's studies that show intensity of gratitude has just as many beneficial aspects. You know, it makes the beneficial aspects of gratitude even bigger. And we can talk about that in a second, what's beneficial. But what you did was you went super intense, like hyper intense. You
extreme gratitude.
Extreme
That's right.
gratitude.
Like they used to say in Mountain Dew commercials.
So you took a cup of coffee and you didn't just say thank you for this cup of coffee. You said thank you to the guy who made the lid. Thank you to the barista. Thank you to the farmers who made the beans. Thank you to the truck drivers. You wrote a thank you to the CEO of Exxon for the oil.
I had mixed feelings about that, but yeah.
Right, well, we could talk about that because that was interesting. I actually... and then there was a lot, so many different directions we could go here, but essentially you thanked 1,000 people who were involved in the contribution of making you a single cup of coffee.
Right. And that was sort of the point of the book, is that it takes thousands, hundreds of people for everything in our lives. So it didn't have to be coffee. It could be a light bulb. It could be a pair of socks. But we take all these people for granted, and acknowledging them isn't just, you know, nice for them. It's really good for you. Like, there's almost a selfish motive to gratitude. Like, when you do it right, it should make you happier. And by the way, before we continue, can I just say, since it's appropriate, I want to say thank you to you, because I did not know the power of podcasts until I was on your show, like really early on. And it was hilarious, because I used to work at Esquire, and I would spend like 2 months on an article, be all proud of it, come out, I'd get like 2 emails. And then I would come and spend 45 minutes on your podcast, and I'd get like, you know, 100 emails. And I'm like, well, wow, not just podcasts, your audience. But
I think
now I don't work at Esquire anymore. So there's a little lesson.
Oh, I didn't know you didn't work at Esquire.
No, that's not true. I still write.
You're
for
like
them.
Editor just, at large or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm contributing editor, but I still, you know, I don't do as much for them, shall I?
I think it was Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert, who said that being on this because I have so many book readers who listen to this podcast, being on this podcast moves the needle for book sales more than being on the Today Show.
Really? Yeah. I love that. All right, let's prove that right.
Yeah, let's prove it. Because we're going to release this like immediately during the week. But the reason this book, there's so many different directions to go. There's 3 main directions here. One is the benefits of gratitude and your adventure in that. The other is structurally how you wrote this, because I think that you have a very unique style, which we've talked about before, but you continued it into this book. And it's always impressive to see that this structure works again and again and again. It's just a massive magic formula you do to create books that I love. And the third way, direction we could go, which we'll go, is there's a kind of capitalism aspect to this, because you mentioned the book iPencil, which was written in the 50s. This book is a little similar, but iPencil was essentially this essay written about all the components worldwide that have to come together and trade with other countries and so on to create one pencil.
Yeah, it's a great essay. And guess who sent me my first copy of that?
Who?
James Altucher.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, you're like,
I think I have early onset Alzheimer's, I really think. But you mentioned in the book that coffee could reduce the risk of Alzheimer's.
That's right, you gotta drink more. Well, that's one study. I can't swear to it. But yeah, no, I love that essay. And thank you. Thank you. I think your name was originally attached to that, but maybe it got edited out. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I was looking through the thank yous at the
end. Is there not in there? That's an outrage.
I don't think I'm thanked in the book, but that's okay.
Oh, my God.
I know.
All right, next round.
But, you know, you said something interesting just now, which is that gratitude could be selfish. But I think actually the original purpose of being grateful is to be selfish. It's just like we were talking to someone the other day, and she mentioned how forgiveness is more for you than for the other person that you're forgiving. And I think gratitude is the same way. And there's all sorts of science that shows, I mean, I was looking right before I came over here, being grateful. And then they had a control group that wasn't grateful. I don't know how they measured this exactly, but a week later, there was less physical complaints. They did more exercise in a week. They felt better about the future. They felt better about the upcoming week.
Yeah,
like, in every factor, they felt
they eat better, they sleep better. Grateful people. Yeah, I mean,
I remember the test was one group did a gratitude journal, the other group did nothing.
Right. Yeah, that is a classic. And yeah, there's huge amount of evidence that it's good for you. And, you know, I never believed just one study, but there are so many studies that...
Like, what else does it help you with?
Well, I read one study that it makes you a better athlete. I don't believe that, but because I spent a year thanking people, and, you know, I cannot run a 30-second 100-yard dash.
That's a good point, which borders into the writing, but we'll get there, but... You did this. It's not like you were just making the point that, oh, we should be mentally grateful for all the 1,000 people who contribute to a cup of coffee. You flew to Colombia to thank the farmers.
Oh, yeah.
Thank the truck drivers. You thank the baristas. You do everything.
I walk the walk. I mean, well, partly it was because what we were discussing, like, I needed it. You know, I feel, and maybe you feel this way too, like, in my mind, there's the... there's the Larry David side and the Mr. Rogers side. And they're battling for the pessimist, the cynic, versus like the optimist, the grateful. And I think I was born with my Larry David side was super strong. Like he was a mammoth. And so
you hide that very well, because when we get together, it's always just cheerful. You seem relaxed. Like,
well, that's, yes, I do. I fake it till I feel it. That is a very important part of my strategy. Like,
so how do you think you've changed this year of saying thank you to 1,000 people?
Well, I do think my Mr. Rogers side has become much more ripped. And yeah, I think it's a discipline. Like, as I don't think it comes naturally to me, but if you force yourself to notice the hundreds of good things that happen every day instead of the 3 or 4 that go wrong, like, it will make you happier. And it will also, one point I want to make in the book is that gratitude's not the same as complacency. It's not like, oh, I'm so grateful that I'm just going to sit here on the couch. It motivates you. It motivates you to do a thing and motivates you to be pro-social and help others.
There's scientific evidence of this.
Yeah. There's some good... Because when I'm in a dark space, I am not focused on others. I am just like, how can I get myself out of this? So, and ironically, one of the best ways to get yourself out of a dark space is to help others. So,
well, did you have a chance to practice that? Like, let's say during this process, you found yourself in a dark space for whatever reason. Did you put this to work and start being grateful, and then suddenly found yourself out of that dark place?
Oh yeah, every morning. I mean, if I would wake up with my default grumpiness, but I would force myself to spend an hour writing letters or calling people or visiting them to say, you know, thanks for your role in my coffee. And sometimes it didn't go well. Like some people were freaked out. They were like, is this a pyramid scheme? What are you selling? But the majority, it was delightful to see, were, you know, I remember I called the woman who does pest control for the warehouse where my coffee is stored. And I said, I know this sounds strange, but I want to thank you for helping keep the insects out of my coffee. And she's paused and is like, well, that is strange, but thank you. You know, I don't get much recognition for what I do. And so it gave me a little dopamine boost, and it seemed to give her a little dopamine boost.
Does gratitude actually spike dopamine?
That's a good question. I'm sure it's one of those good ones. Serotonin, dopamine, one of them.
Okay.
But
it made you happier.
It made me happier and got me out of that, the dark space and the crankiness.
You know, I've written about what I call, I always think it's not enough to just be grateful. I feel like that's easy. Like what we were talking about earlier, oh, I'm grateful the sun's out today. I'm grateful I'm alive another day. Like that seems kind of boring and cliche and doesn't really help that much. I could be wrong. I've not done a study, but it seems like, you know, it's like just like saying hello to somebody, you know, or have a good day. You don't really mean have a good day.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just a thing people say. So if I say, oh, I'm grateful the sun's out, it just feels like something that's easy. So I wrote once about something called difficult gratitude problems. And you talk about, you don't label it that, but you talk about that in this book. Like when you were thinking about how to say thank you to the trucks that deliver the coffee or the coffee beans or whatever it was, you talked about how much you hated trucks on the freeway.
they're annoying. They like,
right. So
you're scary.
So your general thinking is this is something I've hated all my life and I'm supposed to hate because it's annoying. But then you solve the difficult gratitude problem, which is you realize, oh, but I enjoy the benefit. The fact that these trucks are coming in means that I'm going to have my cup of coffee in the morning, so I'm grateful.
Exactly. Like, pretty much everything in my life was on a truck at one point, you know, my pants and my shirt and this microphone. So it's pretty, it's pretty immature of me to be all like, ah, trucks. So and that helps cure a little bit of, it makes you happier. It makes you more open to the annoying things in life that are not necessarily annoying because you need them.
Yeah, and I always use as a classic example when I'm describing this, something similar, which is traffic in general. So I think, like, let's say I'm stuck in traffic, so I'm late for a meeting. I could be anxious and panicked, but I try. But the difficult gratitude problem to get, you know, solving that gets you to the fact that, you know, the reason I'm going to a meeting here is because I live in such a wonderful city where there's all these opportunities. Hence, there's a lot of traffic.
Mm, you know? I like that. So, yeah, it's all about framing. I definitely agree with that.
Right. So, so it kind of leads to that idea that nothing is inherently good or bad. It's kind of how, whether we, our perception of it, whether we appreciate it or not.
Right. And actually, I've been reading up on the Stoics because I'm doing a Q&A for a Stoic, the Daily Stoic. And I do love their idea that, you know, you can't control the outside, but you can control your reaction to it. And I actually did this. This was not for this book. It was for another book. But I remember when I would go to an airport and I would get patted down, like, it drove me crazy. I'm like, oh my God, the nerve of them. They're invading my privacy. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to be able to change this. So at least let me change my attitude. And I'm like, I'm going to picture this as a free massage. Like, this guy is just giving people, pay like $100 to get massaged for an hour. This is the same thing. A stranger just touching me. I'm just going to chill out and let it happen.
There's almost like a mathematical formula that goes along with this, which is happiness equals reality over expectations. Mm. So if your expectations are super high, like, I should be able to just run through an airport and jump on the plane without anybody stopping me, you're going to be disappointed, because the reality you can't change. Someone's going to stop you. You're going to be patted down. Your suitcases are going to be open. Like, that's the reality. And if your expectations are too high, then reality over expectations is very low.
Yeah.
So happiness is very low. But you can change the reality, but you could change your expectations in a second. You can lower the expectations in this particular instance and say, look, sooner or later, I'm going to get on this plane. It doesn't matter to me what happens along the way. And then suddenly your opportunity for happiness becomes much greater.
Exactly. And along the same lines, it's all about noticing the good things, like in an airport or at the, when I go to the drugstore and I am on a line that moves quickly, I now say it out loud to myself. I'm like, remember this, AJ, you are on a line that is going quickly. Because I know if I don't do that, next time I'm on the line that goes slowly, I'll be like, oh my God, I'm always on the slow line. I have the worst luck in the world. But it's not true. It's just because that slow line is so annoying. It's the one that sticks in your brain. We have a negativity bias. I think we've talked about that. Like, you know, if you hear 100 compliments and one insult, you're going to remember the insult. And that might have been helpful when we were cave people. We had to remember the lion or the, you know, one poisonous mushroom. But now it's not a good way to go through life. So trying to get rid of that negative bias is so crucial.
You just mentioned now that you say it out loud. And I know on another podcast, you told me that you do self-talk out loud.
Oh yeah, I talk to myself.
Do you actually say the gratitude thing out loud in that line case?
I absolutely do.
And what's the benefit again? I forget.
Well, there are a few. One, like, you can hear yourself talking. I mean, there's some interesting research on when you're angry, if you start talking to yourself and say, oh my God, I'm so angry, and this is why, it engages the prefrontal cortex, the front of your brain, which is able to, instead of the lizard brain, instead of your emotions, and that is very helpful. So I love that. I talk all the time. I talked all my way up here. I walked up here and I was—
You were just talking out loud.
I was talking out loud for like 15 minutes. Well, part of it was like, well, I wonder what we should talk about on this podcast. What if we, you know, if he doesn't want to talk about gratitude, maybe we could talk about disgust. That's another thing that's on my mind, disgust, and whether it's a good or a bad emotion. And I just rambled on, and I have my earphones in, so people think he's probably just talking to someone on the phone. Like, you know, 30 years ago, it might have looked weird, but now, you know, everyone's just talking as they walk down the street. And I love it. I mean, it clarifies my thinking. If I don't do that, also, it also helps me because I can hear when I start to just do crazy talk and my brain goes into a dark place that's not helpful. and I say the same things over and over again, I'm like, okay, now you're just sounding crazy.
So is it like, I'm trying to understand, like, it makes sense, it engages the prefrontal cortex, but what's the benefit of that? Are you just activating more parts of your brain, or is the prefrontal cortex, it's not going to short circuit your lizard brain, which is sort of more powerful. Like, what's the benefit of engaging?
Well, it doesn't short circuit it, but it helps to calm it down. It's like, you know, you've got the system one and system two, or the monkey riding the elephant. So it's basically waking the monkey up and saying, all right, let's try to get a hold of this elephant that is your emotions, and make sure that they don't run rampant.
So when you're writing the book, say, and you're getting a little frustrated or something, what kind of self-talk will you say? So like writing a book is your high stakes career thing. Like, this
right.
is important to you. And there's probably many times during the writing of a book that you could get stressed. Oh, am I going to finish this? Is there enough material? Are people going to like this? Is it going to sell? Are they going to give me advance for my next book? What's going to happen? So when you run into one of these dark moments while writing a book, what self-talk do you say out loud?
Well, first of all, I do like to talk while I write, like I'm saying the actual sentence. And
William Zinsser recommends, you know, in his book on, I think it's on Writing Well, it's his book about nonfiction writing.
Interesting. Yeah. Do you do that?
I'll do it after an article.
So you'll read it to yourself.
I'll read it to myself out loud. And also before stand-up, I'll practice
right.
saying things out loud.
I do find, yeah, I definitely read my stuff out loud too. But, you know, I'll try to remember the techniques I learned for this book, you know, just realize, you know, you can't control people's reaction, but you learned a lot doing it, and it's going to make some people happy. You know that'll, you know, if it's 100 people, there are going to be some who like it, and there are not going to be some who don't. So focus on the ones who like it. You know, Tim Ferriss talks about this, like there are 300 million people in America. So even if hopefully most people don't hate you, but even if they do, there's still a lot left.
Who like you?
Yeah. Exactly.
That's good to know. At different points, a lot of people have hated me, and they're the ones who speak out.
Well, that is
the
a problem.
People who like you are like normal and sane, mm-hmm. and they're just binge watching Stranger Things every night. The people who hate you are on like they're making YouTube comments saying, "I fucking hate this guy," and they're the ones who speak the loudest.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because I actually, as part of this book, I was like, you know what, that's so true. Like, you go on Yelp and you just see the people are like, these guys are the worst. And it's not true. If you have a good experience at like a barber, why not go on and just give them a positive review? I mean, it helps them and makes you feel good.
I was just in Paris with my daughter, and the very first day we were there, I kind of wanted to just get through all the cliche tourist things. So we went to the Eiffel Tower for like 12 minutes, and then I said, okay, let's get a cab. We went to the Louvre, which is a huge building, but I said, let's just go straight to the Mona Lisa. I'll take a picture of you, and then we leave. And so she just wanted to check the box. I convinced her to check the box on all the tourist things, and then she was free the next couple of days to do whatever she wanted, if she wanted to go back or whatever. But going to the Eiffel Tower, you go on Google Maps, you see, I didn't even know this was on Google Maps. People review places on Google Maps. There's like 75,000 reviews of the Eiffel Tower.
And how does it do?
Well, there are one-star reviews. Like, who, and I didn't read any of them. I should have, because it's funny, but who goes to the Eiffel Tower and says, you know, I really thought it should have been taller? Or I don't know what they say. I've got to read some of these.
Well, know what? That brings up something that I think is kind of important. Because I remember I took my family to France a few months ago, and one of my favorite facts was that when the Eiffel Tower was proposed, all of the intellectuals and artists in Paris were appalled. And they wrote this this huge piece in and published it in the newspaper. And I remember one line was something along the lines of, if this is built, then all the other monuments in Paris will die of shame. Like, the Notre Dame will die of shame. And now it's the iconic Paris. So it's like, you know, People change their minds, and you know, they're reluctant. They're very skeptical of new things, but they will go to. So, Well, whenever you get negative feedback, just remember the Eiffel Tower.
That just reminds me, though, of New York City. You grew up in New York City, and in the 70s, New York City was disgusting, and you know, you were afraid to cross the street. I don't know about you, but I was afraid to like walk down the block, and Times Square was the worst. And I find now it's crowded, but it's great. Like, it's all Disney now. It's much better than when it was all, I mean, I used to walk down 42nd Street as a 15-year-old or 16-year-old, and people would offer me guns, knives, fake licenses, women, and I was scared all the time. Now I find I talk to people, and they're like, oh, New York City used to be much better when it was like a rougher, I don't know, it's great now. Like, it's Wonderland right now.
I am scared of some of those Elmos, like they who scream, you know, they take the ones who take their heads off. They used to not take their heads off, but now all those characters take their heads off. But overall, I agree with you. I mean, I talk about in the book is nostalgia is the worst. The good old days were not good. The good old days sucked. They were, you know, disease ridden, dangerous.
Wait, you've talked about that in a different book.
It's one of my big themes because I think it's a thief of joy, this idea that we should be all in the past and everything was great. It wasn't. It sucked. It was sexist, homophobic. People died all the time. You know, childbirth was like 50-50, whether you would survive or your kid would survive. So, I find this idea of nostalgia, and it's dangerous too. It's dangerous because when you glorify the past, you don't realize how much progress we've made, and then you become a nihilist and like, everything sucks. Let's just throw it all away and elect someone who has never been in office because he can't do worse. Well, in my opinion, he's done a lot worse.
Well, what I like to do is, it's almost like two similar but slightly different emotions, which is feeling nostalgic or feeling melancholy. Mm. I actually enjoy feeling melancholic. I don't know if that's the word. I enjoy the emotion of melancholy where you can look back and think, you know, it was nice being a 15-year-old in rough New York City and surviving. But I separate that out from nostalgia, which is trying to control. Like, I wish things now were like they were back then. I feel that's more nostalgia.
Interesting. I like that. That's an interesting.
Because I had to deal with this when I threw out all my belongings. People would say, oh, it must have been so freeing. You must be so happy. And I realized, no, sometimes I'm sad in this melancholy way, but I avoid feeling like, oh, I wish I didn't throw that one thing out.
Right.
Like I could miss something and feel that was nice to have. And I felt nice about it, but I don't, but if I try not to control with the nostalgia,
right,
it's better. But do you think gratitude kind of helps against these thieves of joy?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think I quote in the book this Benedictine monk who says, "Happiness does not lead to gratitude; gratitude leads to happiness." And there's a lot of studies to back this up. It's like it is, I think, one of the keys, if not the key, to fighting these negative emotions.
And you know, even there's a lot of we're talking about a lot about studies, but you've been a one man in Tim Ferriss fashion. You've been a one man experiment on this, and I've written a lot about gratitude in articles. And there's a lot of science that stress is inflammatory in the system, and inflammation in the body is harmful in a number of ways, from cancer to diabetes to Alzheimer's, as you mentioned here. And gratitude directly fights that. Like, if you're feeling stressed about the airport, that's gonna be slightly inflammatory, even microscopically inflammatory somewhere in your body. But if you replace it with gratitude, it's just, I don't need the science to know that that's gonna be a natural, naturally healthy thing. And there really is all this science that we've discussed. But what would be, and we've talked about the difference of, like, obviously this book is extreme gratitude. It's high intensity. I forget all the different ways they measure gratitude. There's intensity, there's span, like how many things you're grateful about. But you were grateful about many things and with intensity, because you went out and actually, instead of just thinking, I'm grateful, and instead of just saying it out loud, you actually said it to the person, I'm grateful for what you do to get me the coffee. What would be a good exercise for someone listening to this to basically quickly and I think this is possible, quickly change their lives using some of the things you discovered about gratitude when you were writing this book. Not things you knew about gratitude beforehand, but things you discovered about gratitude while writing this.
That's interesting. Well, I would say, I mean, I don't think people have time to do 6 months traveling around thanking everyone in their coffee, but you can do a smaller version of it and just, I call it the gratitude trail. So you just thank, you know, it could be as short as writing a note on Facebook to like the designer of a logo you love. It could be looking people in the eyes. That was a big one because the barista at my coffee shop, when I interviewed her, she said that the worst part is when people treat her like a vending machine and they just hand her the credit card without looking up from their phone. And just like that 2 seconds of eye contact, and I'm not expecting a Nobel Prize for it, but I do try to make eye contact with people because I think that's the way we're wired as humans, is you want a little eye contact. And by the way, this, she wouldn't do this, but I did read like an inside barista's secrets. And if you are too rude to them, some of them will give you
spit
decaf.
In the coffee?
Not spit, decaf. Maybe spit, but yeah. Decaf, which I think is worse. I'd rather have spit than decaf.
Yeah, spit might be kind of exciting. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
So in those two cases, you know, writing a note to someone, I think that's a great exercise. Like if it just takes 5 minutes to find someone you're grateful for and you write them a note.
Right.
And like I've talked about this before on the podcast, but I often I look through my emails that I didn't respond to 7 years earlier. And sometimes writing a note to them is interesting, but I'm going to add a gratitude component to
that. I love
that. See what happens.
So I love that. What's the responses have you gotten when out 7 years later you send an email?
Oh, it's amazing all the time. People are like, oh, I can't believe I heard from you again. Or
that's hilarious.
Yeah,
I want to do that.
And then a lot of times it's in really uncomfortable situations where they really were expecting a response 7 years ago, but all is forgiven after 7 years. That's the thing. It's great. So, but
maybe then, can you respond like, yeah, I'll meet you at the Chinese restaurant.
That's what I do. I say stuff like that. Like, yeah, sure, I'll be up for that coffee. And sometimes people will say, well, I don't really have time now, but thanks for responding.
One other just practical thing when thanking people, if you just say thanks, that can be very robotic, like reflexive. And there was actually a study by Wharton that showed if you say other phrases like I'm really grateful, that has a bigger impact than just saying thank you. So mix it up, like actually put, and also put some thought into what they did. Like instead of saying, I would email these people like, you know, this woman who helped farmers, and I say, you know, I know it can't be pleasant out there fighting the mosquitoes and the hot sun, so I really appreciate you did this for me.
What I love about all the things you just said, and I'll write them in the article that people will see about the book, all of them are things that are interacting with others. So there's going to be a part two of this in 1 minute, which is you telling me where you're not interacting with others and you've learned through this process. Because in this book, you're interacting with others. You physically say thank you to 1,000 people. But there must have been things that you've learned to increase the intensity of your gratitude where you're kind of by yourself, like you say, to push anger or these darker moments out. But I'm going to get to that in a second because you inspired me in this book. A, by the way, I've been looking everyone in the eyes when I've been ordering coffee. Like, we're drinking coffee right now that I got you before this podcast. And I looked that woman in the eyes. I said, thank you. I should have said, I'm grateful for this, but I said, thank you. And she was smiling as a result, as opposed to like people just looking down and putting their card in the thing. And
we are great human beings.
But you inspired me to call the professor who threw me out of graduate school in 1991.
No way.
And say thank you to him for throwing me out of graduate school.
Because you wouldn't be here if you had stayed in
I would have taken would have been a professor of computer science, which I didn't really want to be. And I went a totally different life. I'm really happy with
this. Is fantastic. So I cannot wait.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
I'm grateful I get to see this.
And just in full disclosure, I did call him a half hour ago and say I was going to call him.
But he doesn't know why.
He does little.
A little, okay.
Hello?
Merrick, it's James.
Hey, James. How are you?
Good, good. So I mentioned every... So first off, Merrick, meet AJ Jacobs. AJ, meet Merrick.
Hello, professor.
So
thanks. AJ, how are you?
Good, thank you.
AJ, Merrick is the professor who in 1991 officially signed the letter throwing me in disgrace out of graduate school where I think I failed 75% of my classes and finally they asked me to leave. And Merrick, I'm calling to say thank you for that because my life has turned out to be infinitely great. I don't know how my life would have turned out otherwise. I probably would have been a professor somewhere, which nothing wrong with that. But I'm here on stage now with AJ Jacobs calling you and saying thank you. And people are going to learn about this.
What are you thanking me for, James? Are you thanking me for you're failing the classes and my having to write the letter? I don't think that...
Yeah, I'm thanking you. I'm thanking that you... forced me out of grad, and he didn't directly force me, but I chose my, I earned my failure out of graduate school, let's put it that way, but you're the person who wrote the letter that actually took me out of graduate school, and if I didn't have that letter from you, my life would have turned out differently, and I like the life I have, so I'm grateful to you, I'm deeply grateful to you for, and we became friends after you wrote this letter. So another reason why I'm deeply grateful to you is that this letter became like an odd point of contact for us that manifested into a almost 30-year friendship now.
You know, it's interesting. The letter itself, I think the faculty should thank me for writing it because I ended up being in this tough place where I didn't want you to have to leave graduate school and the faculty, and it was my job on behalf of the faculty to write that letter and actually fought quite hard not to write that letter. So they should thank me for the letter, but you know, the fact that we were able to develop a relationship, keep our friendship that letter was important to me. You were the first person I ever had to say something so strongly no to that I was able to then maintain a relationship with all these years. So thank you too.
Yeah, it's unusual to get we should be enemies. I should be like that guy kicked me out of school. But
how about in our next life we'll be enemies? But how about you? Like, you forced me to have to write this stupid letter to you, which I didn't want to have to write.
But you got to be friends with him after. So that's something.
Yeah.
And you get to be on the radio.
We were friends before, but it was hard to be friends through that, actually. And I appreciate that. Yeah, it's funny how these kinds of things where you kind of, I can see how writing that letter must have forced you. I wasn't thinking that at the time, I think, but I was probably mostly worried about myself at the time, which is not fair. But I can see how getting a letter like that would kind of require you to have to grow in some way. And so,
well, there's some interesting research that says when you're fired from a job, for instance, you have the same kind of feelings or the same neurochemicals or whatever as when you experience the loss of a loved one. And being thrown out of graduate school, even though I literally asked for it by failing all these classes, you know, it felt like a death a little bit. And, but we both, you know, I'm grateful then for the friendship we developed after that. It's like a miracle.
I know. It's very important to me in my life, and it's miracles. I just want to say something. You know, I don't remember that you actually failed this class because that might give people who are listening the wrong impression. I don't think you could actually fail a class that you actually went to. I think what happened was you were involved in other stuff and you didn't show up. That was the problem. And then the professors probably had to give you failing grades. But I wouldn't want to accidentally say that, like, you tried something that you failed at, because I don't think that's actually what happened.
Well, I remember I stopped showing up to your class, for instance, and then I didn't even go to the final. And because your class was hard, man. What was he teaching?
What was the class?
It was a very mathematical, like theoretical computer science, and it was hard.
Maybe it was boring. I don't know. Maybe.
And what were you doing when you were not at class, James?
I was starting to begin writing. I began my writing 3,000 words a day, and I was at that moment obsessed with playing the Asian game Go.
Oh, interesting.
And so those two things basically kept me from going to class.
I love it.
That's true.
And so without being thrown out of graduate school, I probably wouldn't have written books, for instance, unless they were computer science books. So I'm grateful to Merrick for you throwing me out so I wrote books other than computer science books.
Okay, and I'm grateful for the books you wrote because there, some of them are good enough that I keep buying them and giving them to the people because I think they're terrific.
I'm grateful for that.
Yeah.
There you go. Okay, this is a gratitude fest.
You can get into an infinite loop. It's very it's dangerous.
So AJ, when you were...
And AJ, that's what you're doing, right? You're sort of tracking down like a chain of gratitude, I gathered.
Yes.
Yeah, really exactly. And it can be, it reminds me of computer science because it's a tree that just branches and branches and branches. Like every stop on the with the cup, you can thank the lumberjack, and that'll lead to like 100 other people because he has the he's got the chainsaw, and then you need metal for the chainsaw, and you need a helmet for the people who are mining the ore for the chainsaw. So yeah, it's dangerous.
It's crazy, right? So I was reading the beginning of something that you wrote where you were going to the coffee shop and you started there, and I was thinking, well, what about the elevator? What about the country? What about the shoes you're wearing?
Exactly.
It's this weird sense that you have that the only way that our lives are at all possible or easy is that there were a zillion people that came before us that left something here that made our lives a little bit easy. And I'm sort of at a stage of my life where I think about that the other way, which is how hard it is to figure out how to leave something. So that people that come later, because we're only here a short time, how people come later, it's easier for them. And yeah, so it's very cool what you're doing.
Do you think that's possible? Because like, think about the most famous people of the 1950s. I'm just picking it an example. This is 70 years ago. My kids have no idea, for instance, who Chuck Berry is. And he was maybe the most famous musician of, 1953.
Well, first of all, it's really sad that they don't know that. You should fix that right away.
But like most, I would bet and, none of their
friends.
But
ideas. It's really interesting. So like ideas, they're kind of ephemeral. So you make changes and it affects people's lives. I mean, you've affected an enormous number of people's lives, and you told me just now. I might have affected yours. So I think that that laugh that they may not remember where it came from, but even something as simple as you just make something. You know, sitting on a bench or standing on your shoes. Like somebody actually made that, it went into the future. Alan Kay said something recently that just struck me. He said, what are our emissaries to the future? And what kind of emissary to the future are products? But it's actually kids that are the emissary for the future, or people that we teach, they're the emissaries into the future. So maybe that's the answer. Maybe the answer is most you can do is show somebody else how to be in the future when you're not here.
Well, I'm friends with this guy, Will McCaskill, who's an Oxford philosophy professor, and I love him. But his new obsession is thinking about not just like our grandkids, but like our 70th grandkids. Because for the first time in human history, you know, when we were cave people, you couldn't really affect the future. But now our actions can affect the future for a long time. So we've actually got to start thinking more long term, like not just tomorrow,
So that's interesting. I mean, I know there's a Long Now Foundation too. It's sort of been trying to think on these terms, but really, what could you do that affects the future that far out? I have trouble affecting the future like next week, I think.
Well, it's adjusting your priorities. So you're looking at the existential threats to humanity as opposed to like the little problems of today. So, looking at pandemics, at climate change, and trying to encourage your politicians to focus on that. Because no one's talking, we don't talk about the big nuclear war. That hasn't gone away. You know?
But I would say, like, to Merrick's point about the next generation versus dealing with something so global as like a pandemic, you're not a pandemic kind of scientist. You're probably not going to do anything that will help.
Maybe I should be, though.
But if you could raise two or three good human adults, that's a very difficult assignment that evolution has given you, and that's how you affect 70th grandchildren, because then they'll have a more likely to raise good kids.
And just
what it doesn't have to be so grandiose. It's just in every conversation you have with a human being, they go off from the conversation as an endless.
Right. And raising your kids to be mindful of the future humans so that maybe I can't solve the pandemic.
And Chuck Berry, don't forget. And Chuck Berry, you have to be mindful of Chuck Berry.
Yes. We got to add Chuck Berry to every conversation now from now on.
And Chuck Barris, isn't he the Gong Show guy?
Chuck Barry.
Chuck,
yeah. Yeah, everyone's going to forget him in a generation.
I've already forgotten his name.
And he was the most famous person in the 1970s.
So, AJ, can I say, give up? So, if you look back and say, before you wrote this book, are you grateful to somebody for having given you this idea? Where did the idea for the book come from? I love the idea.
Oh, well, thanks, yeah.
My mind spins out of control thinking about it.
I will say, you know, what James is doing now, I love. And I actually did a similar thing. I called this guy. He never fired me, but he was one of my first editors at a tiny newspaper in California. And I was, you know, I called him out of the blue and said, I just want to thank you. And it was awkward because, you know, I think as a man, it's a little awkward to be emotionally available and vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But I found it very meaningful, and I think he liked it. He wasn't too freaked out. I think he liked it. So, I want to thank him. And you know what? I also love what James says about how something that seems terrible at the time can actually turn out to be good. So, like, you know, my friend who was my first editor, I was friends with him before I wrote a book. And I was like, oh, I really want to write a book. And I came up with all these ideas, and they were all crappy. And they were all like, you know, I wanted to write a book about redheads. And he's like, you're not a redhead. That's a terrible idea. And it was. So I'm thankful for him for rejecting all the crappy ideas until I finally found one that we both agreed was a good idea.
That's interesting.
Good, because he saved you being rejected by everybody else that you might have cared about more. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I feel a little bit sad, though. You called me to say this, and maybe there are other people you wanted to call and...
No, Merrick,
you're like, I've muscled into a conversation here, but I love this conversation.
No, Merrick, you were literally the main person. You were the first person I called when I thought of doing this in the podcast. I'm so glad you were able to do it. And I really mean it. Like, I really am grateful that you in particular were the one who wrote the letter throwing me out. I'm grateful I got thrown out of graduate school and that you were the person who wrote the letter, because I think the many benefits have come out of both.
Is there still a copy of that letter?
I don't know. Do you keep your email?
That's a scary thought.
I would love to read it.
Oh my God, I want to frame that.
I'm just imagining it's funny that you said that. It just hears an embarrassing thought. So as you said that, my first thought was, gosh, you know, I have all these laptops that are closet somewhere. Maybe on the right time I said, oh, darn, there was no chance that there was a laptop back then. So maybe there was...
No, it was 1991. There wasn't really laptops.
It was like a VAC 780 or something that took a whole room. So I don't know. Maybe. You know, there's hardly anything ever disappears from the net.
Well, can you still log into your CMU email accounts?
No, they finally took that away, remarkably enough.
Yeah, because I was able to log into mine for like 10 years after I was thrown out, but I would use that for all sorts of purposes.
that I'm not sure I want to know about.
Well, you know what was interesting?
No longer connected.
You know what was interesting is that most people, this was like, this is just a tangent. This is in 1990, say, your mailbox on Unix wasn't really read protected, not yours specifically, but like most people didn't protect their mailbox. So you could actually read everybody's email back then.
That's great. And now you can again.
You can't.
Well, Merrick, thank you so much for participating in this. I'm so glad I was able to talk to you, and I'll see you Thanksgiving weekend.
That's great. And by the way, it's hard to accept that. I didn't realize that until just this, as much just a second. So, but I have this weird feeling, like, I don't want to say you're welcome for sending you out.
Wait, what did you say?
I'm just trying to figure this out. So it's a little hard to accept gratitude.
Mm.
I think AJ just said a moment ago, when you were saying you felt a little uncomfortable about expressing it, now I'm feeling like that. I'm just noticing it's a little hard to hear it. And then I was just thinking, well, I wanted to say thank you. But I want to say you're welcome or something,
how do you accept gratitude?
You're welcome.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You're welcome for getting kicked out of graduate school. I don't know if that's right.
Yeah, because I think in general,
doesn't sound right, but
in general, it's hard to receive any, like, people have a hard time taking compliments, for instance.
Yeah, it's true. And it's a little awkward. I mean,
so
to me,
what should his response be?
I guess the idea is like there's some study on paying it forward, you know, just like go and thank some, have an awkward conversation with someone else. So that thank someone who fired you, and then you will feel good, and that person will have to do it to someone else.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. Well, I didn't think I needed help having awkward conversations, but I can go have one now. anyway, thanks for including me in this. And AJ, it's really nice to meet you. I hope it'll be more than just like by phone sometime.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks, Vern. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, James.
Bye.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Bye.
What do you think? How did it go? How do you feel?
Good. Yeah. No, you know, Merrick knows I've been grateful for him for throwing me out of graduate school, and particularly the friendship we developed afterwards. But, you know, I think it is an interesting exercise for people to think of not just today, who I can be thankful for, but kind of dig into the archaeological layers of your past. Those layers are what are the foundation that built who you are now on.
Right.
And, you know, if that foundation didn't exist, you wouldn't be here. So, you know, it's like thanking your mother and father for existing, but there's more, that's kind of an evolutionary thing, but there's more nuances, like the professor who threw you out of graduate school, the guy who fired you, the girlfriend who broke up with you.
Yeah, I love that angle. Like, because it also must be empowering, like, to take something that was so negative in your life and be like, you know what, that was the best thing that happened to me.
Yeah. So now, before the call, you were talking about ways of interacting with other people. What about things you've learned since starting to write the book about just how to build gratitude inside yourself in general? That could be a takeaway from this that I can learn from.
Well, one is that since we do have this negative bias, we're so good at noticing what goes wrong. Take 2 minutes a day and just try to make a list of all the things that go right. So it could be, you know, you press the elevator button and the elevator comes, and then you get in and the elevator doesn't fall to the basement and break your collarbone.
Let me ask you about that, because you mentioned that in the book, and I thought you basically give a list of things that don't happen bad.
Yeah.
And that seems negative.
Well,
you actually didn't say in the book, like, oh, okay, I got to the subway in perfect health. You said, I didn't fall down the steps.
Well, that is my Larry David side coming out. I would say, yeah, there are two ways to do it. One is the it could be worse, which I think is a very powerful way to look at life. So yeah, it could be worse. You know, I could have forgotten how to, I could do what I'm doing right now, where I'm stuttering. It reminds me, my first radio interview, I was kicked off of the air because I started stuttering so badly that they were like, we got to end this. He's like, thank you, AJ Jacobs. So I want to thank that person, because it made me commit to really being much better at speaking. And I took every opportunity to go speak. That was a little tangent. But I would say you can either focus on how all the terrible things that did not happen, which I think is actually a powerful way to look at the world. Or yes, you could try to focus on the positive things, like, and I talk about that with savoring is a very important idea.
Savoring is interesting. So that's very much in the present. Like, if you have a cup of coffee, rather than just drinking it down while you're thinking of all these other things, you specifically mention how you savored the taste, you kept the liquid in your mouth for 20 seconds and enjoy
it? Not even. I don't have 20 seconds. I'm not that patient. You know, all you need is 2 seconds just to focus on the taste and the texture and the sweetness. And I often now try to think of my life as a series of moments, and that I'm sort of a collector. I'm like collecting a bunch of good moments in the museum of my life. Because otherwise, if you don't focus and pick out those moments, then it's all just goes by in a blur. So I really do try to have in my mind a list of good things that happened.
So let me throw an example at you. Let's say you had an acquaintance, a good acquaintance. Let's say it's a work friend or whatever at Esquire, or I'm just making this up, or the publishing company, and they threw a huge party for Christmas and they didn't invite you. And normally, and let's say that you and I both are not big party goers. I know we've gone to parties, spent like all of 15 seconds, and then escape them without saying goodbye to anyone. You taught me that technique a year or so ago. But let's say you weren't invited to the party and you're feeling like, why didn't he invite me? Does he not like me? How would you now deal with that differently than before you wrote this book?
Well, I would say, I mean, first of all, like you said, I often, instead of have FOMO, I have FOBI, fear of being included. But pretending like I really wanted to go to this party. I think the important thing is instead of stewing, which I'm very good at, I would take action. I think you would, you know, throw your own party, invite a couple of people over, or do something new. Like, I've been wanting to go to the underwater virtual reality exhibit by National Geographic. So yeah, don't. It's much better to replace something than to try to get over it.
And this you figured out after you started writing this book.
Yeah,
that's an interesting thing. So replace instead of FOMO.
Exactly.
So all right. What's another thing internally? I like to say it out loud. I'm going to throw that on the list.
Say it out loud. Well, this one is, this is an internal thing, though, that definitely did change my life. And I can't take credit for it. It was a woman, when I was giving a speech, she taught me the trick. She was in the audience. When you're trying to fall asleep, go through the alphabet. And instead of counting sheep, count things that you're grateful for alphabetically. So, you know, sometimes I start with A, sometimes another letter.
Wait, but, so this is when you're trying to go to sleep.
Yeah, when you're lying there, and instead of obsessing about what went wrong that day or what's gonna happen tomorrow, focus, go through the alphabet. You know, like yesterday, I made we don't have a kitchen right now because we're remodeling. So we made an apple pie with my kids, an oven-free apple pie, just with a blender. And that'll be one of, like, A is for the apple pie, the oven-free apple pie. And then B could be any, you know.
You baked the apple pie.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little cheap, C, but you could do it.
You put frosting on the apple pie so it became a cake. E, you digested the apple pie.
You are good at this.
After eating it, E.
Yeah.
And then you went on an F fast to lose weight that you gained from the apple pie.
I do try to mix it up more, but it's a good strategy.
So that's a unique one. And does it help you fall asleep?
Oh, my God. Like, I rarely make it to the... I don't want to say I never have, because that sounds like... because it's kind of crazy that it works that well, but I don't think I've ever made it to Z.
So all of these things, you listed some things where you interact with people, and you list some things that were on your own.
Well, you know what? This one is interacting with people in that category, but to promote this book, I decided it would be interesting to write 1,000 thank you notes to readers of any of my books or articles. And actually, I thought this was kind of James Altucher-ish.
I think you did actually write something to me. But I can't remember. I feel like you wrote something to me. Look, this is a. It's listed as potential spam, but I just want to see.
Sure.
It says the consulate general of some office. Let me just see who it is.
Oh yeah, no, you got to get that.
Hello? Oh no, they hung up.
That could have been an ambassadorship.
I know.
They were offering
maybe
you.
I was being offered a job.
Damn. But I have. I mean, I have on my website. ajjacobs.com/thanks, and there's a little form you can put in your name and your snail mail address, and then a message you want me to write, like anything. It could be like, you know, you love the Seattle Seahawks or the Jolly Green Giant, you know, maybe no judgment, that's fine. And then I'll write a personalized note, and I have, it's simultaneously one of the biggest pains in my ass ever and one of the greatest things ever, because I have gotten... I've loved the feedback. I've learned what people like, so it's actually good for a writer. And
what do people like?
Well, just, you know, my wife, Julie. they love Julie.
Thank God you're so patient with
exactly.
AJ.
So
let me ask you a question on that. Is it better? Do you feel better, or is there any science on this? Is it better to write a handwritten note, or is it better to rather than an email, or does it not matter?
I don't know of any research officially, but I mean, analog in this case is huge. I think certainly when I get a note, a paper note, that makes it much more meaningful. And
it's like what Merrick was saying. How do you accept that? Like, I get I get handwritten notes, and sometimes I get nice notes and other things, and I get stressed because I don't know how to. I can't write handwritten notes. I like lost the ability to handwrite other than on my notepad, which is unreadable. So
can you outsource it? Can you hire someone to write a note back?
But then that seems like
That's not
loses the point.
Well, I am not expecting anything back. I guess that you've got to change your mindset. So be like, instead of being stressed, focus on how nice it is that you got this. And I will say,
but then I'm afraid people will think I'm not being respectful to them if I don't respond.
Well, you know what you can do is, I've had a lot of these people who have received the notes, they tweet it and they say,
That's a great idea.
And it was awesome because, like, yeah. I loved that they got it. I mean, weirdly, it helps me from a selfish point of view because, like, then, you know, my name is on their Twitter feed. So maybe that's the secret. You don't have to respond. Just tweet them. Take a picture of it and tweet it and say thanks.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you about. I mean, there's a lot of things, but you mentioned how Barbara Ehrenreich writes about what she calls the gratitude trap. Like, Walmart teaches their employees to be grateful, but that's somehow a weird trap so that the employees then feel like, it sort of prevents the employees from complaining back to Walmart, like, oh, we should have more money. Walmart doesn't say what you should be grateful about, so the employees just become in general, grateful we have a job, grateful we're for our salaries, so there's less complaints back to Walmart from employees. And Barbara Ehrenreich says this is kind of this bad gratitude trap that corporations or the oligarchs do on the working class. Now, then you called Scott Barry Kaufman, who's a mutual friend of ours. I've been on his podcast. Weren't we going to one time take the Partridge Family bus down to UPenn and speak at his class?
I would still do. Oh, he doesn't work there anymore. Now he works at Barnard. It's much easier to go to.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, he lives here.
I'm going to have to visit him. But Scott Barry Kaufman disagreed with that, but I don't... And then you kind of went along with his... In the book, you went along with his thing, but I sort of think they were both... He didn't really answer her question. He said to you, and you mentioned this in the book, he said to you, no, feeling grateful makes you pro-social, more generous, and so on. But that doesn't necessarily contradict what she said. They could be feeling pro-social towards Walmart and not complain about their salary. So he didn't really respond to her criticism.
Well, I would say I still agree with him. And I think the research backs it up empirically. People, when they are grateful, are more likely to help others. So it could be that when you're grateful at Walmart, you know, you want to, whatever, you want to unionize, you want to help your colleagues have more power. The idea that I was very afraid of this, that gratitude would lead to complacency, and that you would just be like, oh, my life is crappy, but I'm so grateful for it. But it's really, the empirically, that's not the way it works. It's that when you are grateful, you go out, you become more aware of others and try to help them and make. And I saw this, like with water, since coffee is 98.8% water, I'm like, I gotta thank the people who give us water, which is, there are hundreds of people who work in the New York reservoir system, and they're not all glamorous jobs. I mean, there are people who have to literally pick up deer poop around the reservoir so it doesn't wash into and poopify our water. So I think that's a verb. But
Which, by the way, wouldn't matter for coffee because it's heated, so it'd burn away.
No, our water's not heated. Oh, for coffee. Yes. You're right. Good point.
That's why you can drink coffee in places like India where normally you wouldn't drink the water.
Right. But that brings up, you know, once I started to be aware of the fact how much goes into our water, it made me realize, you know, this is very unusual. 99% of humans throughout history did not have access to clean water. There are still billions of people in the world who do not have access to clean water. And I got it. I asked my philosophy professor friend, who's great with altruism, like, what's a great organization to help with water? And he recommended this one called Containers for Clean Water. So I recommended that, and I gave some money to that. And I would say, the whole idea of gratitude, it doesn't make you into this dull sheep. It inspires you.
Where Barbara Ehrenreich is getting her, let's call it insight from, is kind of the history of, you know, for the past several thousand years, emperors, kings, whatever, have used, you know, as Karl Marx would say, religion is the opiate of the masses. And, you know, people feel, serfs and whoever, feel grateful for their god or gods or whatever, for over centuries and thousands of years. And that's what keeps them happy doing their surfing work instead of being a king. They don't uprise.
I don't know if that's, I mean, empirically, I'm not sure that's true. Like, you know, I don't think your average serf was grateful. I think they were depressed. And the more depressed you are, the less likely you are to have a revolution. So, to me, and from the studies I read, like, it is actually, you know, it's, you want to be grateful to affect change. So
this is to your quote earlier, happiness doesn't bring about gratitude. Gratitude brings about happiness.
Right.
Change doesn't bring about gratitude. Like, your life's not going to change and then suddenly you're going to be grateful for it. Gratitude will bring about positive change in your life.
I love that.
We've made our own new quote for history.
All right. Printing up the t-shirts now. Love it.
I wanted to ask you again about, we've talked about this on other podcasts, but there's the AJ formula for writing a book, which has come up with this high stakes macro idea. Like, in The Year of Living Biblically, it's what would it be like to live now by the word, literally by the word of the Bible. In Drop Dead Healthy, you spent a year just doing everything you could to be healthy. In My Life as an Experiment, you have all these experiments that you do, including outsourcing your arguments with your wife to an outsourcing firm in India. And it's all
very
relative.
Grateful.
Rather than just talking about how we're all related, you went and found all, you know, you held the largest family reunion in history. And
featuring cousin James Altucher.
Yes, I spoke at it. It was great.
Loved it.
And I remember signing in right next to Dr. Oz. My kids were like, that's Dr. Oz. And now he's since been on my podcast. But you had the largest family reunion in history. You went out. It seems like you come up with these high stakes thing. And then I feel like any other boring writer would just sort of write about, well, this would be like to live biblically, but you put yourself into this high stakes concept and live it. And so that's how you generate story. And then you intermix with the story, you go into the theories and the history and like you know, the science behind gratitude and the questions that come up and interwoven is your personal journey through this. And I think it's just an excellent way to write a book. Like what's a high stakes thing that you haven't done? I mean, you've dealt with religion, saying thanks, obviously, genealogy, which millions of people around the world love, health.
Well, that's very, first of all, very nice of you. And I love it. I mean, it's
and it's
fun
funny
way.
Too, because it's to put yourself in these weird, like when you, like in Year of Living Biblically, you have to stone somebody who's an adulterer. That scene, I won't describe it, is funny. And then and then in Thanks a Thousand, this book that just came out, you calling the woman who does the pesticides in the warehouse, that was a funny scene. Like you're a modern day Mark Twain. You make all these stories that involve you funny, which again wouldn't happen if you were just being if you were writing a philosophical book about gratitude.
Right. Well, I feel, yeah, I like to live it, and I think it gives me something to write about. And as to your question, what else is it? I mean, I love getting suggestions from readers, and some of them are at work and some don't. I mean, one very common one, I don't know if I mentioned this on the show before, but people say you should try to be the greatest lover in the world and do all the positions in the Kama Sutra. And I actually brought this up with my wife, Julie, and she's like, no way. That is like, no, that's exhausting. Plus, we don't have the flexibility. I think we're too old. Like,
you gotta, it's tantric yoga. You got to be able to do yoga.
Yeah, so. I know. She does yoga, but I don't think I have. So that one will never happen. But I do like getting suggestions because it lets me know what people are interested in.
You know, because a lot of it is also about getting out of your comfort zone. Mm. And when It's All Relative came out, remember we did a kind of fake, I wanted to do this and you played along. You were very nice. We did like a fake talk show on a subway about your book.
I loved it.
We did the exact format of a talk show, but did it on a subway and then walked up to people who were quote unquote in the audience, but they were really just sitting on the subway and asked them about if they were related, how far away they thought they were related to us. And it was a lot of interesting cognitive biases occurred. So it was interesting.
It was super awkward, but I liked it.
But maybe that's one you can do is, the comfort zone and somehow every day you do one thing to get yourself out of your comfort zone.
That's nice.
So, but then you'd have to, it's not as clean as this though. This is clean because it's like a cup of coffee, all the people you have to thank who got you this cup of coffee.
Right.
And the Year of Living Biblically, just follow the Bible. Dropped It Healthy, just everything you do healthy. The one I just said is complicated. You have to think of a new thing every day. That's like hard work.
Well, simplicity really is. I love that. I mean, to me, that's one of the keys to a book. It's just, if it's a simple idea, but you go deep on it and explore it from every angle. But the idea that you can sum it up in a sentence, to me, that I love that.
You know, there's a genre of people, and you probably know all these people, and some of them have been on the podcast, but there's this genre of reporters who study an obscure game or athletic subculture and then become champions in that subculture.
Yeah. So like, and I love those.
So like Josh Bower, who became like a Scrabble champion, right?
I think he was Memory, another guy who did Scrabble.
Yeah, so he was a U.S. Memory champion after just being a journalist about it. Then he got obsessed with it.
Yeah, I
the
love
other
that.
Guy, Stephen Fatsis,
yeah, that's it.
Did Word Freak about Scrabble. He became like a Scrabble champ.
Great book.
Andy Bellman.
Andy Bellin.
Yeah, Bellin.
Yeah, a friend of mine. He did. He became great at poker. Another good book.
Yeah. So, and then there's a guy who was keeping a blog about putting in the 10,000 hours on golf, but he recently gave up. He had an injury after like 6,000 hours.
Oh, that's hard.
So, but he got pretty good. But that could be another thing where you're gonna decide to be like a violinist and you're gonna put in the 10,000 hours. But then it's gonna take you years and years to write that because you got to put in the 10,000 hours.
Right. Well, remember, I actually at one point, and you were involved in this. I was gonna write about, it was sort of Shark Tank the book. I was gonna be an investor, and I would take my advance and invest in like 10 different companies, But the problem was that you can't really see whether a company does well for like 6 or 7 years. And I was like, I can't wait that I got to write a book before 6 or 7 years.
All right, I'll give you an idea, but it's outside of the normal AJ formula. I will make you a millionaire in 1 year if you follow my advice exactly.
Okay, done.
So that's if you wanted to do that, I would do that with you. You could be the writer. I won't write anything. But that's not quite your style, because it's then you just depending on me to kind of help with the content. You kind of create your content, and you have multiple people,
right,
who are in your cohort.
I would need a bunch of, but that would be all. I mean, first of all, if I did make $1 million, like imagine, like that's the best advertisement for James Altucher. And if I didn't, like think of the conflict. I'd be so angry. I could write like this crazy book about our friendship, and then we could, like you, we could bond together over it, and
right,
I could
forgive
you.
Like I did with Barrack right here. Yeah. Right here. What's another high stakes thing? Anybody in the audience, what's a high stakes thing? Because I feel like it always seems like you've covered every high stakes thing, and then you come up with the next high stakes thing.
Well, I want, you know.
Dating is a high stakes thing, but you're in, and you've talked about your marriage, you've written about it, and you're in a marriage, so you're not going to do dating. So what's another high stakes?
Well, it's interesting because in the Bible, in the Old Testament at least, it says that you can have multiple wives. So I brought that up to Julie when I was writing about the Bible, and she was not that into it. I actually interviewed the head of
Next
the
time,
polyamory,
on the James Altucher
the, I mean
show.
The polygamy, the Christian Polygamy Association, and I was like, you know, it's an interesting idea, but how do I actually make it happen? And he said, don't ask for permission. Like, you know, shoot first, ask permission later, whatever that is. That he said, go out, get your second wife, marry her, and then come home with her and say, honey, I'd like you to meet my second wife.
That is such horrible advice. I'm glad you didn't take it, but
I certainly did not take
your
it.
Life.
Yeah.
There was one I was just...
Well, some people have suggested, you know, trying to create world peace. Like, can I solve the Middle East conflict?
But even if you could, what would be the story? Like, it's not like you're going to, it's not like the prime minister of Israel and Egypt and all these places are going to meet with you. Like,
that's true.
You'd have a hard, you could come up with an idea, but you're going to have a harder time writing your personal journey through it.
Right, right.
So again, I'm thinking of a high stakes thing. Again, you've done health, you've done, you know, again, I was thinking, like Josh Foer became U.S. memory champion. But again, that was a journey that he documented, but that could take years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing I'm fascinated in, it's not ready yet, but with CRISPR and DNA slicing and robot, like what does it mean to be human? Like, can I become human 2.0? So I'd be part machine, I'd be Android, I could get my DNA so I could glow in the dark and I could
so like, that's
be
a great one.
10 feet tall.
The problem is it might be better to write that book 10 years from now than now.
Right. I'm so going to put
you
that
might,
on the
you might do
the
all the
list.
Work and it's just out of date almost instantly, or you can't get enough material or whatever.
Right.
Whereas like this is just saying thank you to 1,000 people. Not
exactly.
Just, but you know ahead of time you can create this story.
Yeah, this one is timeless. But you're right, that one needs to wait. I mean, because there are some, there was an article about, I think it's in Scandinavia, where people are getting implants in their hands so that they can like get through security at their job. You know, it's like an ID card, but it's in their hand, so they don't have to carry it around. So it's sort of starting where we're becoming androids. But we've got a ways to go.
I bet, I mean, biotech is in general increasing at such a fast speed that it'll almost seem old hat, some of the things you do now,
yep,
just 2 years
true.
From now.
Well, it'll be also interesting, I mean, people who are doing CRISPR at home, like, can I be Frankenstein? Can I create a new form of life? I don't actually want to mess with that.
Also, you don't necessarily want, your style is not to necessarily be a journalist where you're just going to find all the people who are doing that.
Right.
Like that you need to do it.
No, I would need to do a CRISPR in my bedroom.
And by the way, also, because we talked a little bit about skill acquisition, like the memory guy or the poker guy, none of your stuff really requires skill acquisition.
Mm.
Like you had already all the skills before you wrote Thanks 1,000 to thank 1,000 people.
Right.
You had the skills to live biblically before you went and lived biblically. Another one, the know-it-all, where you read the Encyclopedia Britannica from A to Z. You had the skills to read.
Yeah, I did. You're right.
So that's another criteria, is that you need to kind of already have the skills
to
do the thing.
Although maybe I should go the other way. I mean, I love the quote from Kevin Kelly, you know, one of the founders of Wired, that the skill that you're going to need in the future is the meta skill of learning how to learn. Because whatever you learn is going to be out of date. But if you learn how to learn, so maybe learning to be the greatest learner in the world would be interesting.
Well, and a little bit, that's why I like doing this podcast, is because what I get out of this is not just all the great and amazing things you just said about gratitude, but each time we get a little further in studying the A.J. Jacobs style of writing, which is not such a bad thing to study, because all your books become New York Times bestsellers, and they're great books, and they're funny, and they're in all the bookstores. Your books are the only books that consistently I will see in every single airport bookstore forever. Like, all of your books are in
every
airport bookstore.
That is lovely to say. Well, thank you. I mean, you know what I could do is I should take a lesson from you and learn how to self-publish books. That would be interesting.
Yeah, because then you could write smaller books. You don't have to fit the traditional format of a book. You could play with format a little bit. But again, I'm trying to figure out what's a good high-stakes thing.
Well, I love what you do with your bookmark. Like, when you offered a refund to people who didn't like your books. I think about that all the time.
That actually inspired
me to write the 1,000 gratitude notes. But sorry.
By the way, you know who inspired that idea was Kevin Kelly. He wrote a post that no one's done that before, so I did it.
No way.
And so Kevin's been on the podcast twice. Kevin and I wrote back and forth about it. He said he didn't know technically how one could do it to keep, so I just figured I'd just do it manually. A lot of times people think they need to build software or something that's
right.
just as easy to do manually. So I just offered it manually, and it was interesting. It was a good technique. Kevin's a smart guy.
And people didn't, did you get anyone who asked?
Yeah, it was like a slightly less than 1%.
But it paid off.
Yeah,
some
people thought I was gonna go broke doing it because you have to pay more than you make.
Right.
But it totally paid off, and it worked, and it also got me media opportunities because I was doing that.
I love that.
So I
also love when you printed your entire book on a t-shirt and wore it around.
Yeah, that one worked. You know what I'm doing for my next book? I'm putting it on Amazon for sale for $1,000.
So that's the only price? You can only buy it for $1,000?
Right, and it relieves the pressure of trying to sell lots of copies. Like, you know, there's a stress. Like, you look at your Amazon rank all the time. My Amazon rank is going to be horrible because I'm selling this for $1,000.
So you only need to sell like 50 copies, and you'll be hopefully more.
We'll see. Or you can say, look, I'm giving you a gift. I could give away 50 copies and look at my charity write-off. I could show anybody. It's on Amazon for $1,000. This is a real $1,000 gift, $50,000 gift.
It's hilarious.
So, just for one more minute, is there another high stakes thing? You know, investing, you know, trying to become a world-class investor is one, but that's a little bit skill acquisition.
Well, one thing I am very interested in right now, it's not a very funny word, but hopefully I could write a funny book about epistemology. How do we know what we know? Because that to me is the most high stakes thing in our world right now, because we've got these different realities and both sides accusing each other of fake news. So how do you actually know what's truth? Who can we trust in this post-fact, post-truth world? And I think that it's actually super important.
I agree. It's funny. Yesterday I asked this on Twitter. I just simply asked the question, can someone explain to me what fake news means? Mm. And I got three types of responses because the world's polarized. I got four types of responses, to be fair. One said essentially whatever the Democrats think is fake news. Mm-hmm. The others said whatever the Republicans and Donald Trump think is fake news. And they said it in much more nasty ways, but that's what they said. A third accused me of trying to be provoking, and that I must be either alt-left or alt-right. Like, I got accused of being both, mm-hmm. and people were angry at me. And the fourth category. There was a few people who did try to balance it out. Like, some people think this is fake news and some people think this is fake news. And then there was, a fifth category, which basically said everything is fake news. And I kind of belong to that category.
Interesting. You think everything is fake
news? Well, I've been on tons of news shows, and you and I both have written for lots of newspapers. And there's nothing really. Most things are just either someone's personal story or not reality.
Yeah. Well, I actually think about this a lot. I think there are, I do think the New York Times is very important and that they do try to report the truth. But I think that media, the problem is man bites dog is the major paradigm for a news story. That's what's interesting, man bites dog. But really, we should be writing about, instead of man bites dog, 20,000 dogs bit men, you know? And because it's not interesting, but then we would be able to say, oh, okay, now let's solve this problem. Let's figure out.
Yeah, but negativity bias, you're 20 times more likely to read, open up a newspaper, buy a newspaper that has a negative headline.
Well, that's the problem.
The classic New York Post headline, headless body in topless bar.
Right. I mean, it's the huge problem. It's like, instead of one person was sucked out of the window on a Southwest flight, it should be like, can you believe 400, a million people landed safely in this metal tube? Like, that's insane. That should be the focus, not that one person was sucked out.
So if someone's listening to this, they've got a lot of great takeaways on gratitude and some on the AJ writing style. But if you were to come up with, if someone said, I want to be a writer and I like the way AJ writes, I like his style, what are three suggestions you would give to someone who wants to, switch careers or start a side thing where they start writing? They want to start building the skill of writing. And because of the way you write, I feel you're a good model to focus on, because you, again, high stakes, plus you put yourself in the story and then you document it.
Right.
Boom, that's a book.
All right, let me come up with three. I have two in my mind and I'll come up with a third while I'm talking. One to me is just the importance of the title. Titles are unbelievably important in books. And it's funny because our mutual friend Tim Ferriss, when he before he had written a book, he called me and said, I'm a first-time writer. I'm writing a book called Drug Dealing for Fun and Profit, which was because he had some sort of nutraceutical company that he would, he was selling and he wanted to write about it. And of course, that eventually, the title was changed to 4-Hour Work Week. He changed it to that. And that, to me, was so brilliant because I would pick up 4-hour work. Like, who doesn't want to have a 4-hour work week? Whereas Drug Dealing for Fun and Profit, I'd be like, I don't know. Should I? I don't know if I want to be seen on a plane reading Drug Dealing for Fun and Profit.
So the title almost should be somewhat aspirational.
Aspirational and super clear. Like, I think one of my most successful titles was The Year of Living Biblically. It's exactly what it says. It was, I spent a year living biblically. And maybe one of my least successful titles was The Guinea Pig Diaries, because it's like, is it about guinea pigs? I don't even know this one.
Is that a book?
It was a book. It was an anthology of sort of shorter, like, experiments. But it was supposed to be a human guinea pig, but it didn't really work. So clear title.
So I'll give some insight into this. My most successful book is Choose Yourself. And the way I picked the title was I had a list of, like, let's say 10 titles, and I made Facebook ads out of each title.
I love that.
And then the ads didn't go anywhere if you clicked on it, but I didn't care. I had small budgets, so only like 50 or 100 people saw each ad. But I would see which ads were clicked on the most, and 80% clicked on, or 90% clicked on Choose Yourself, and then all the other titles were way down.
That's
so I knew statistically.
Yeah.
That title would work better than all the other titles I was considering.
I think that's a great idea.
So that's number one.
What was just one rejected title, for my own knowledge?
Pick Yourself, which Tucker Max suggested. and the Choose Yourself Era, which was my original idea.
Interesting. All right.
Because Choose Yourself Again, it's a little
clear.
Bit more, it's like a call to action.
Right.
It's a little more aspirational.
Love that. All right. Number two would be just what you said. Like, I think the most successful books strike an emotional chord. You've really got to connect on an emotional level, not just an intellectual level. And thank God for my wife. Because I think that's what people, when I describe, you know, I can describe the journey and what I've learned, but how it affects my personal life, my wife, my kids, my job, that is what people latch on to, because we are, you know, our brains are wired to focus on anecdotes.
So that's the combination of what we were talking about. Like, it's high stakes enough to affect not only you, but all the people around you. And then part of the story is not just what you do, but how it's affecting all the people around you.
Right.
And it makes it simple because there's this high stakes filter, you're simply documenting it. And it's funny.
Yeah.
Because it's such a weird thing, like living biblically or outsourcing your marital arguments to India or thanking 1,000 people for a cup of coffee. It's kind of funny, just that filter and how it affects all the people around you. So high stakes plus documenting not only your reaction, but the reactions of the people around you. So, okay, right. Number three
is, and this one is, I feel a little conflicted about it because I am actually not an extremist. I think extremism is terrible and it's the most dangerous thing is like political extremism right now. However, if you're writing a book, I like to take a concept and push it to the extreme and then live it and see what happens. So, you know, take the concept of outsourcing. Well, if I push it to the extreme, it's like, well, what if I outsourced everything? So not just my work, but arguments with my wife and reading bedtime stories to my kids. And so take it to the extreme. But then at the end, make clear extremism is bad and here are the good things to keep. And here you can get rid of it.
Well, and even in Thanks 1,000, part of the story is you exploring what the extreme is.
Right.
Like, should you thank the parents of all the people you thanked? You know, like that becomes an important question in the book. That's part of the story itself, is where is the line? And this is where you are able to look at the research and talk to, you know, professors, philosophers, scientists, friends, and you know, that becomes the story itself. That becomes part of the story, is like, how extreme do you go? How extreme do you go with living biblically? How extreme do you go in trying to be healthy? How extreme do you go in building, you know, contacting every one of the thousands of people on your family tree? How extreme do you go in like trying to memorize the Encyclopedia Britannica from A to Z? So I think that's really interesting. I think that's the A.J. Jacobs three-step technique to writing a best-selling book.
I love it.
I have an idea. I'll make you a millionaire. You can write about that. And I'm going to try to write an A.J. Jacobs-style book. And you'll coach me on that.
I will love it.
My
and
first
I will
thing
blurb
is I
got to
figure out the high-stakes thing.
All right.
And then I'm going to do it.
We're going to figure it out. What about, didn't you podcast straight for like 48 hours once?
I was going to do it, and then enough people convinced me not to do it. But your friend and fellow editor at large at Esquire, Cal Fussman, he and I agreed we're going to try to break the record, but without the necessity of hiring Guinness, just break the record.
Yeah, definitely do that. But yeah, that could be, why not just a year again? Podcasting live for a year. I would listen to
podcasting
James.
That's the extreme.
Yeah, exactly.
So I love that. All right. Well, AJ, I am so grateful that you came on this podcast once again. I could have you on this podcast every week. I'm sure we would never run out of things to talk about.
I am extremely grateful. I won't say thank you since that might come off as too robotic, but I am very grateful. I loved it and I love being on your show.
Excellent. Thanks, AJ.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.